from 1984. That's Cold Shot, the late, great Stevie Ray Vaughan. Let's say you're doing a show on this kind of a topic. You want somebody who's beyond the mortal plane to join in the conversation. How do you say it? You speak in seance sort of language, Forrest J. Ackerman, come on down. I don't know, but I do know that seances were conducted, and I do know that, according to witnesses, Forrest J. Ackerman did show up and communicated with a couple of different people, and it manifested himself in multiple ways at the mansion where he used to live, the so-called Acker Mansion. In a moment, we're going to be joined by the current owner of that mansion to talk about some things that have happened there, and we'll be talking with Paul Davids and John Allison about their attempts to get to the bottom of it and to get in touch with the late, great Forrest Ackerman. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Davids, I want you to help me sort of set this up and the segue into the person who's going to join us in a moment. You know, the things happened at your place in New Mexico.
Yes.
They started happening to John Allison in New Jersey. They happened to other people in multiple locations. But I guess if you were going to look for evidence of Forrest Ackerman showing up, you'd look at the Acker Mansion. Talk to me about that place.
Right. Well, before the break, I was saying that John's incident of the pages scattering mysteriously was duplicated, something that had happened at the Acker Mansion, where I had interviewed a musician who lived there, who would set up music pages on a stand down near where Fari's old office was, and she had an interruption for a phone call or to get a drink or something. She'd come back, and she'd find her pages scattered all over the place. And it happened repeatedly. So I drew a connection because the phenomena was similar. I interviewed another tenant there. This, you can see their interviews in my film, The Life After Death Project, a fellow named Justin who saw what he described as sort of a black shadow person form moving across a wall and then across another wall and then into a bathroom at around 3 in the morning, and there was no one else there, but he clearly saw this, and he talked about feeling presence in the house. Well, eventually I got in touch with the current owner of this 18-room estate. It's been entirely remodeled since Fari was there, but, you know, still the same basic house. And Mark Rawlings, the current owner, invited me to come for a number of days and bring a team of researchers. And so this was our return to the Acker Mansion. And actually, John Allison wrote the chapter. It's the last chapter in our book, An Atheist in Heaven, describes what happened in our return to the Acker Mansion, which included a carefully planned seance.
All right, let's bring Mark in. Mark Rawlings, you own the Acker Mansion. Do you live there?
I do, and good evening.
So have you seen weird stuff?
It's funny. I've had the property almost 10 years, and really had no activity until about 5 or 6 years into that, when I was awakened one early morning about 4 a.m. with a figure of a lady floating above the bathroom door right off of my bedroom. And I thought that was odd because there had been many stories that I had heard through time about a man, which I just assumed was Forrest Ackerman. But mine was not that at all, and nobody had ever seen a woman, but that is indeed what I did see. And it kind of started the whole ball rolling, and then ultimately the seance that we did last year was a culmination of that.
I didn't realize, Mark, until a couple days ago, you're friends with George Norrie. You've known him for a long time.
Many decades. I know him from St. Louis. I was his first friend in Los Angeles because we had been friends many years when he moved out to take over the show. Yes.
A small world, isn't it? And then you end up owning the Acker Mansion.
It was funny. We had a conversation a couple of years ago, and I kind of led him down a path, and I was talking about, you ever heard of the Acker Mansion? He said, yeah, but he didn't put two and two together. I said, you know, that's my house, right? He goes, oh, really? It's pretty funny.
So let's set the scene for the seance. Whose idea was that? Paul, yours?
Yes. And, well, Gary Schwartz, we have to give him, I think, most of the credit because Gary, let me say a few words about my co-author, Gary Schwartz. PhD from Harvard in psychology, taught at Yale, currently professor of psychology and several other subjects, tenured professor, University of Arizona in Tucson, runs the Laboratory for Advances in Consciousness and Health. And he, in addition to studying instrumental transcommunication with spirits using computer technology and software he is developing, he has studied mediums for, I think, around 15 years, dozens of them. And he separated those who are sort of the wannabes or think they can do it but really can't from those that really have an identifiable ability. And in Life After Death Project, two of those mediums were filmed. They didn't know who I was. They weren't told about Forrest J. Ackerman, just that I, the man with the camera, wanted to communicate with Forrest. And what came through was astonishing.
Oh, it was amazing.
So what Gary did was set up to bring Suzanne Wilson and Jamie Clark, two psychics, to the Acker Mansion, in addition to other scientists. Now, John Allison came out from New Jersey. Rosemary Guiley was there, who's written many books on the paranormal. The Steckless family came. They were experts in gorilla studies, scientific gorilla studies. They had been in charge of the Dian Fossey organization in Africa for many, many years. They came and they brought the death mask of a giant gorilla, sort of as an offering for Fari because he was so obsessed with King Kong. And we planned this the seance. There must have been 10 people there. And Suzanne Wilson took the lead with it. And was there phenomena? Yes. But before we get to that, well, we still have Mark. Mark is still here, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mark, some of the things you told me about the footsteps on the landing. There was the incident with the iron where somebody asked you, do you have an iron in this house? And then immediately the iron that's inside the closet crashes to the floor. There was the night you told me about where you heard such loud noises upstairs. And were you the only person in the house then? You said you just had to leave the house. So there was a string of things that began to happen to you that caused you concern. Am I right?
Well, it's funny because it's not on a regular basis, but the loud noise banging was the only time I've ever actually left the house. And that was fairly recent. That was only 3 or 4 months ago. And it was just myself and another person. And I'm normally like, yeah, you hear noises. It's almost a 100-year-old house. But this was almost insistent. Like somebody wanted my attention or wanted me to leave. And I don't know why that would be because that's never happened. But it was a series of banging and then nothing, and like anything, you're like, oh, I'm hearing that. I hope it will go away. And it didn't. And it did it 4 or 5 times. And I just packed up and left, which that's pretty big after 10 years of ownership there.
So, Mark, until that point, what are the phenomena you had experienced was almost like playful?
Frightful? Was that the word?
Playful.
Play.
Yeah, that's a good word.
The woman you saw, you said sort of 1950s hairdo, and Fari's wife had lived in the house with him one day, and she had passed away in the house. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes. Yeah, the lady was middle-aged, blonde bob hair, a horizontal black and white striped top, and not much below that, a haze. Almost like something you'd think you would see. And as long as I would look at it, it was there. And finally, I just went for the light switch. And I think you noted in the book that I never stayed down there again, which I have not.
You have
all the activity down there. Seems to be the lower level. It's a three-level house, and the lower level see many, many people. That's where they've seen things, and more than just me.
And that's where Fari had his office, the main part of the museum, the collection. You know, hundreds of masks and monster props and horror movie placards and everything you could imagine. Most of it was downstairs.
And Mark, have they shown you photos of Mrs. Ackerman since you saw this apparition? Is it a match?
She's an older lady than that. But from the way when Paul and I first discussed this, you don't always look at the age that you passed away, or it's more, she was probably 20 years younger is what I saw.
Here's something really interesting, Mark. One of the first things that happened when we were investigating at our return to the Acker Mansion, Suzanne Wilson at around 3 in the morning started to be woken up repeatedly. There was no lock on her door. She saw a silhouette of, looked like a man coming into the room. And one time he shined a red laser pointer across the room, sort of, and right at her face. And she was very upset by this. And then she said that the spirit of a woman came to her after that happened. And, she said, put her arm around her and said, you know, don't be afraid about that, darling. She said, that imbecile won't come back. Now, I thought this was really interesting because Fari's wife was German, and she used to use the word imbecile. You know, that's sort of a kind of European thing to do. She would call people an imbecile. And so we noted that. We noted the fact that the following night, Suzanne reported her bed shaking in the middle of the night, vibrating. She wondered if it was an earthquake. And then came our seance. And John, are you still with us? Can you tell about what you saw and the report of, you know, with the shaking of the couch and all of that? It's your chapter in the book covers it.
Right. We were probably two-thirds of the way through the seance. And as Paul said, there was this Steckless family there, a mother and father and two college-age kids. And the father and I had a few conversations throughout the week to try to decide who was the least convinced that there was any such thing as paranormal phenomena. Who is the biggest disbeliever? Was it him or was it me? And we never came to a conclusion, but two-thirds of the way through the seance, suddenly he got a look on his face and he said, the couch I'm sitting on is vibrating. And his son, who was sitting on a chair behind him, reached out and touched the couch and said, yep, it's vibrating.
And Suzanne Wilson had just before that said Montague Keene was coming through. He was a life-after-death researcher who had been involved in the skull experiments. And she said, two of you last night asked for a sign, and it's not going to be the sign that you asked for. The Steckless sons were shocked at that because they had asked for a sign and they hadn't gotten that sign. And she mentioned what it was they had asked for. She said, there'll be another sign. And we're hearing from Montague Keene. And then the couch began to vibrate. Now, I want to say that after the seance was over, I wanted to check the couch, you know, the pillows, you know, because the first thing my devious mind would think of is, you know, did somebody leave a vibrating sex toy in one of the pillows. But no, I checked all the pillows, and also no one knew which room we were going to hold the seance in until we at the last minute said, we'll do it here. So there was no possibility of any, you know, of any...
sabotage.
No, there wasn't. There wasn't. And I went so far as to sleep on that couch that night, and nothing happened. It didn't vibrate again, but we caught the vibration on film, just like I do want to say, I want to make it a point that a number of these strange things that happened along the way were caught on film where I had the camera rolling. And John Allison, the clock in your house has always been one of the biggest mysteries to me. Would you say a word or two about that? Because it ties into all of this.
Right. This was right after Paul and I discussed the papers falling off the chair, and Paul wanted me to talk about it, so I was sitting in the living room, and he was filming me, and an old wind-up clock went off.
It chimed.
Yeah, it's a chimed, yes. And it's a family heirloom and covered with dust because it's just a little bit too far away. It's behind a sofa, behind a bookcase. I never touch it.
Does it not work?
I don't know.
I mean, you
did anything with it.
You have to physically wind it to make it work if it's going to happen, right?
That's right. And we went back and looked at the film after it chimed, and the clock, in fact, had been running. It had a little pendulum in it, and it was ticking away. After that, I took Paul back to his apartment or his hotel, and when I came back, it was silent again. So.
And it hasn't chimed again since, right?
No.
And it hasn't chimed again.
Let me get one more question in for Mark, because he's going to leave us here in a couple of minutes. Mark, your impressions of the seance or other events in the house, you mentioned that something had happened just a couple of months ago. Anything else you want to share with the audience, your take on what's going on?
Well, I mean, to me, the seance, I went in as, you know, I'm more of an observer. And when Paul and I first started talking, it's like, I said, why don't you guys come and stay and we'll see it. But the seance was an interesting experience. It went for hours. It was very draining in a way. But I walked out really feeling like I saw something, I learned something, I opened my mind to it. And there was continued activity, but no more or less than there was before it. I've had walking noises. I've seen doors open and close, but other people have seen more things than I have. Some just because I think they're more prone to see it. But it was really an open experience. And like I said, then like 2 years go by and there's nothing, and then there's a ton of activity again. And that's pretty much what happened. Sure.
Have you looked into who owned the house before Forrest Ackerman? I mean, maybe there's something else. Somebody else is floating around there as well.
Yeah, you know, Paul, you know a little more about
yes,
that.
Yes, John Hall. He was the actor Ramar of the Jungle.
Oh, yeah.
And the day he died, his picture fell off the wall, we're told.
But he died elsewhere. He didn't die in the Acker
Mansion. He didn't die in the Acker Mansion. But wasn't the picture in the Acker Mansion?
Yeah, it was. And he was one of the original owners, or the original owner of the house. And so they always thought that his ghost had occupied it as well, but not really seeing a facial feature on the men anyway. Never been defined.
You know,
Mark Rawlings, I want to thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. And, you know, we'll keep an ear out for this, and Paul will keep us informed, and maybe we'll have you come back. I'd like to see the Acker Mansion at some point. That's
very good. Anytime, cool George. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Dr. Allison, I want to ask you something. We got about 2 minutes before we go to the break, and I realize you're a chemist, not a physicist, but I wonder if you could help us just a general understanding of the physics of this, because it's some disembodied spirit, is there some kind of principle in physics that would explain how something on some kind of different plane, different level, can physically affect things here? I don't know. There's certainly no easy answer to that, but I'm sure you've thought about it.
You know, we ended up with, I think, 12 people in the room for this seance, and there were about 12 people on the other side. And there were comments flying both ways. I was really fortunate to be able to sit next to Suzanne Wilson while she was trying to take notes as fast as she could of who was saying what on one side and who was responding on the other side. And I mean, you know, if you're trying to take notes on 12 people having conversations simultaneously, it's a difficult thing. Plus, report it. It was really amazing to watch. But there were a lot of questions that were answered for me just in terms of what their life was like on the other side. You know, nothing fantastic, is just, you know, we're here now. Fari has a lot of friends, and they spend a lot of time in the same space in his house. They party there.
Including H.P. Lovecraft, who showed up that night.
Oh, I want to hear more about that. ELO is telling us we need to take a break here. The song is Telephone Line. We'll be back in a moment with my guests talking about the book An Atheist in Heaven. Much more to come, and we'll open up the phone lines with your questions and comments. We're talking with Paul Davids and Dr. John Allison about An Atheist in Heaven, The Ultimate Evidence for Life After Death, a new book that Paul co-wrote with Gary Schwartz with contributions from Dr. Allison. Before that, it was preceded by a film project. The Life After Death Project was available on DVD. And I watched it again today. It's highly entertaining and inspirational almost. I mean, now, ultimately, that's what this boils down to, is the idea that there is the ability to get scientific proof that life goes on, that there's something else out there for us. And it also is kind of encouraging. When we come back, I want to pick up the conversation about this seance and what came through and some of the other personalities that were perceived as being in the room and communicating with the folks who were there. Much more to come, and we'll get your questions and comments as well on Coast to Coast AM. I want to go back to the conversation about the seance and the perception, at least by the medium who was conducting this thing, that there were multiple personalities, personas, spirits, whatever you want to call them, on the other side, all talking to folks on this side. Dr. Allison, I don't know how you feel about seances and mediums and that sort of thing. I kind of keep an arm's length from it because I've read so much about phonies in that field.
Right.
There had to be part of you going, this can't be true. But what did you perceive was going on there, and who else was floating around in the room?
It was the documentary that Paul made where I got to see mediums in action, really, with, you know, no information at all, just talking about, you know, calling Fari, and Fari comes to them and they just respond. They describe him, talk about intimate details. I mean, just seeing that alone was really pretty amazing for me.
That was what was
in the film.
The film and Atheist in Heaven. Yes, it was Catherine Yunt, and then the Israeli psychic Orit Ishyemeni Tomer.
You can see that, or
read about it in the book. But that night, for example, I remember at one point she said, "There's a Howard. Howard has shown up, and he's a frenemy of Fari." Sort of a friend enemy, and does anybody know a Howard? And we all said no. And then she said his last name begins with L. So Joe Mo immediately blurted out, you know, that sounds like Howard Lovecraft, who did have a love-hate relationship with Fari. Fari was too much of a critic of his work early in his life, and then eventually they became friends. So that was one. And then she said that Ray Harryhausen had shown up. He was one of the pioneers of special effects movies. I think we all saw his movies as kids, the Sinbad movies and Jason and the Argonauts, and he was a very close friend of Fari. And I had made a film, another film called The Sci-Fi Boys, about the history of special effects and film that dealt with the influence both of Fari and Ray Harryhausen. And so that was something when she said Ray Harryhausen was there, and she mentioned Harry Houdini, who, as we know, was a great skeptic in his lifetime. I have a whole chapter about his skepticism and his fight with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes, because they, you know, they respected each other, but on the issue of spiritualism, they completely disagreed. But my co-author, Gary Schwartz, in his research with instrumental transcommunication, has data involving his attempts to contact Harry Houdini. And in the book, there's actually graphs that show what happened on the computer during his, he calls it HHH, hypothesized Harry Houdini, where in response to attempts to communicate with him, the bar graph getting some kind of radiation or electromagnetic field just went off the charts. It just was, he said it's like the ball out of the ballpark and out of the city. So there was that history of Gary Schwartz and Harry Houdini, and she said Harry Houdini was there. And then another one I remember was she mentioned Nikola Tesla.
That's a pretty star-studded cast.
And John, as you said, she was writing, the words were just coming faster than she could write, right?
Right. It was amazing to watch.
But so, John, would you say, having been a part of all of this now since 2009, when you first began the research, see, we're about 7 years into this, I'm really interested in you explaining how your point of view about all of this has changed. Because when I first came to you, it was, look, we're looking for an answer to your ink problem that doesn't have to do with a ghost. Are you prepared to say that your mind has been opened and you think that all of this may be possible now? Where do you stand?
What I think really changed my mind was hearing from the people on the other side during the seance, just talking about their life there, which you rarely hear too much details about. And, you know, it sounded like Fari found a lot of his old friends, and he still hangs out with them. But people like Tesla, if they were looking for someone like Tesla, they were, looking to find more than just people who like to drink or something. And what really hit me was they thought it was funny that we couldn't project more on them in terms of what they were doing. And they said, well, you know, we do things too here. I mean, there are important things in the afterlife that need work.
Did they say what?
What do the spirits in the afterlife want? What do they need? What don't they have that they want? And the answer was, they want to be able to communicate with us better.
And didn't she say that Fari still wanted this involvement with the world of film, and when he and people making films?
Right.
And he had assignments for me.
That's right.
Three assignments, she said. And then when she began blurting out what Fari thought of contemporary movies and his criticisms of, you know, the scripts and the stories, and I just thought, wow, this is exactly what he would say.
Yeah, he just went off on a rant.
He went off on a rant through her, yeah, through her, I don't know how to call it channeling, but it's, she was conveying what he wanted us to hear.
Right, we got a couple of folks on the line. I'm going to go to the phones in a second.
Okay.
I wanted to ask about Dr. Michael Shermer. In the film, the Life After Death Project, there's Dr. Shermer in his now familiar role as the premier sort of skeptic, the voice of skepticism, modern skepticism. You know, he addresses a lot of paranormal type topics. He's not harsh necessarily or angry like some skeptics have been over the years, but he is a tough guy to convince. And since that film came out, there have been some dramatic changes in his attitude toward the general.
Oh yeah, something happened to him, just like the Fari case. It happened on his wedding day, and he wrote about it in Scientific American. He wrote it as an article called When Something Happens That Challenges Your Skepticism to the Very Core. And he went through that. I also want to say that he said sort of jokingly in my film, while we were making the film, he said, look, you know, as far as the afterlife goes, I'm for it. Nobody's
right.
Against
we all are.
It. He said, I want to see evidence. I haven't been convinced. But he had an incident happen to him that was, I think, about as striking as my ink obliteration. I also want to say to all those who have said they think Paul David's made all this up, Paul's a filmmaker, and we think he's having a fast one on us. And, you know, I've reiterated that isn't so. This is all true. And Michael Shermer wrote a dedication to me. One of his books he wrote to Paul, in respect of your honest search and integrity. And to me, that means that the executive director of the Skeptic Society and publisher of Skeptic Magazine has signed off on the fact that he's satisfied that I've been honest in all of this, that it's an honest search, and I've approached it with integrity. So for those online who have wanted to attack me with those accusations, I think I think we're past that. Between that and the fact that John Allison vetted me so completely, and his conclusion was the ink obliteration, I couldn't have done it if I wanted to, and that's a fact. And John, I think you would say that you're much more open-minded about these phenomena now than when this all began.
We could certainly say that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call or two. First-time caller, Chris in Ferguson, Missouri. Good morning, Chris.
Okay, good morning. I'd like to start with, I found my dad deceased in this house in 2013. And ever since then, there has been knocking noises and doors closing on their own. In the past year, I had actually seen the Shadow Hat Man appear in this basement. Every night for the past year, I can feel an invisible entity crawling in my bed and making my bed shake. I bought video equipment, and I have recorded a couple of things, quite a few movies that I haven't even looked at yet. My grandson was here about 6 months ago, and he actually seen the entity. And he described it as being approximately 8 feet tall. It's white in color, has horns, has a mustache. He said it's powerful enough to tear this whole house down.
But it hasn't, right? So is it menacing? Has it done anything bad, or is it just a creepy feeling?
It is very something. I can't explain everything, but I can tell you what it does. It puts me to sleep. It gives me nightmares. It draws my strength and my energy.
Did you say
like
this?
I guess they would call a psychic attack. I don't know for sure what this is. So that's actually, all these things that we're talking about are 100% accurate, and I do have a little bit of video.
So my question would be, in response to Chris, to you, Paul, you know, I guess when you open these doors, you don't know exactly who's on the other side all the time.
You don't. You know, and, you know, when I started out with the first night with the ink obliteration, I was really scared when that happened. I was afraid, and I didn't believe in demons or, you know, this paranormal stuff, you know, but I felt I was in the presence of something, and I said, unless you have my very best intentions, at heart, I want you to leave. I want you to get out of here. So that was my initial reaction. No thought that this was my friend saying hello and keeping his word of dropping me a line, but that became increasingly clear. And as it became clear, it became more like the continuation of a friendship that didn't end with death. It's like checking in with me from time to time with things that happen that I can't predict. And yet I've recorded them all diligently. As you know, George, because you've read An Atheist in Heaven now, you know there's 140 things in the glossary of the book, which is also filled with photographs of all the evidentiary things that we can have, all the people involved. So I've been diligent recording it, and I welcome it now. And there's been nothing negative or, you know, it hasn't been scary. I feel like it's fari. Now, beyond that, I don't know. Now, there was one night, I mentioned this in the book, okay, there was one night when our shower door downstairs, just for no reason at 2 a.m, shattered into like 10,000 pieces, a glass shower door. I don't know what caused it. I don't know why that would have happened. And, you know, I don't know why most of this would have happened, but I do connect most of it to my friend. And I think that's wonderful and hopeful. And the fact that his personality is maintained, his sense of humor. I want to mention something to you, George. It's happened while we've been talking here. This is just a synchronicity. You know, it's a coincidence. But I've talked about the importance of Joe Moe, and his name is spelled M-O-E. And I'm sitting in my dining room right now, and we have a steel wine rack that has wine and champagne, and I had never noticed this before, but my eyes went over to the bottles, and right in front of me is a bottle of champagne. It's Moët champagne, M-O-E-T. But as I looked at it, the T was completely blocked by the...
So all you see is Mo.
Yeah, all I saw was Mo, and spelled as Joe Mo's name, which is M-O-E. And it, again, you know, it's just another, it's just a little coincidence. We're having this conversation right now, and I didn't know that bottle was there. You saw the story of the bottle of wine in the book.
Yes.
In the movie. Extraordinary. Absolutely incredible that when editor and music supervisor Sean Fernald came to work on the show. My wife, for that weekend up in the mountains while we were editing, brought up a random bottle of wine. We have all of this wine here that we never drink because we're gifted it. We're in the film business. We get it all the time. And it just stacks up. And she grabbed a random bottle. She took it up there. And it happened to be the same rare type of wine that he had served on his wedding day when Fari was there, and Fari drank that wine, and the year on the bottle was the same as the year of his wedding. So we call
that was a pretty amazing coincidence. Try to get one more call in. Jeff in Culver City on the wild card line. Hi, Jeff. Better make this a quick one.
Yeah, real quick. Hi, George and Mr. David and Mr. Allison. Yes, it's true that the dead do live on despite what the Bible says about the dead being asleep and not knowing anything. Apparently, certain people can access the dead in multiple parallel dimensions wherever they may be at any particular point in time. Jesus Christ himself came back in John in Revelation to talk with him and show John all the things he needed him to see. Remember, lots of books of the Bible are missing, have been changed or altered, and even additions have been made by those who claim to have been inspired by God. Jesus said in the last part of Revelation, do not add or subtract from what has already been written. My question is this, Mr. David, Mr. Allison, since there are multiple parallel dimensions where the dead are still operating and doing their thing, what could possibly be the reason why they're still active within our current reality? And I'll take your answer up here.
I'll give two quick answers. Yeah. One, I want to, you're quoting the Bible, and I want to remind people of Paul seeing Jesus on the road to Damascus, and that would came his conversion. So Jesus was dead at that point. This is after the resurrection. Time had passed. He said Jesus came to him. So that story is in the Bible. As far as the reason in this case, we called the book An Atheist in Heaven. Fari was an atheist, but he was a futurist, and he cared about scientific discovery. He said he'd let us know if he was wrong in his totally atheistic beliefs. And I think the same as what author Richard Matheson told me. You know, Richard Matheson, he wrote books about the afterlife, including...
We're about out of time, Paul.
What Dreams May Come. He said, I do believe Fari has come back to correct himself, to correct the error he made and let you know. And that's how I sum it up.
Paul Davids, the new book, An Atheist in Heaven, co-written with Gary Schwartz and contributions from John Allison. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. I appreciate it, and I hope people will check out the book.
Thank you, George, so much.
All right. Thanks. Thanks also to Charles Brandt and to Mark Rawlings and to my colleagues who helped produce the show tonight, Jeff DeRay, Donna Walker, Dan Galante, our webmaster, Greg Bishop, and our producer, Chris Boros. I'll be back next Sunday with my guest, David Politis, who will unveil his new book in the Missing 411 series, and it's another blockbuster. Good night, everyone.